My Classic Album with Mike Norris is part of Podnose, the UK's leading independent entertainment podcasting network. For episode archives of My Classic Album and all of the shows on the network, visit us at www.podnose.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Podnose or send us an email via admin@podnose.com.
It's just like a wall of awesomeness coming at you. That's how I would describe the whole album.
It's just been a lot of fun for me, Mike, to talk with you about this album at this moment.
It's something that everybody should hear at least once in their life.
It's fucking amazing!
You're listening to My Classic Album with Mike Norris.
Hello everyone and welcome to another edition of My Classic Album, looking back on some of the greatest albums in music history. I'm Mike Norris, thank you very much for joining me for yet another episode of the show. We're really ticking along with these this year, which is great. Today, an episode I've been excited for you all to hear, an album that I've felt should be taking its place amongst our classic albums for a long time now. We're going to be looking at the debut album of Southern rock legends Lynyrd Skynyrd. Of course, that album is known as pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd. I'm sure that you'll hear my guests today, guitarist from Sons of Liberty, Fred Hale and Andy Moose Muse. I'm sure you'll hear them and myself shorten that to pronounced throughout our conversation over the next hour or so today on My Classic Album. But it's a great album and, you know, for me, very much ground zero, if you like, of Southern rock, you know, very much where it all begins. And a lot of the bands and singers that I love, you know, you'll hear us chat a little bit about probably my favourite band on the scene at the moment, Blackstone Cherry, you know, certainly a band who will have been inspired by Lynyrd Skynyrd. So, you know, these are, you know, a fantastic band, a fantastic album, and a great conversation coming up for you all to hear in just a little bit. But first, a bit of a call to arms for one of our special anniversary episodes. I know that long-time listeners of the show really enjoy it when we dive a little bit deeper, when we really dive into a truly classic album and we do it in time for a significant anniversary. Now, this one is pretty special, I think, for a couple of reasons. Now, 50 years ago, in May 1972, Wishbone Ash released their third album, Argus. Now, anyone who has maybe not had the pleasure of listening to this album, I know a lot of long-time listeners to the show are fans of this album, maybe looking forward to us covering it on the show. Wishbone Ash are actually a very influential band, and Argus is an extremely influential album. So when Dan Morris from Firekind chose the album to talk about on the show, and it just so happened that our conversation would fall on 50 years of that particular album, it seemed like the perfect opportunity to celebrate, as I said, a really influential album in Argus, which, you know, for many reasons, which I'm sure we'll get into, and I'm sure that longtime fans of the band and the album will already know. What's great about that episode as well, however, and we've only been able to do this a couple of times on occasion, but it's really exciting when we do, is that we've been able to chat with someone who was heavily involved in the production of Argus. So if you go right back to the first season of My Classic Album, we celebrated 40 years of Rumours and 40 years of Battle of Hell back in 2017. On those episodes, we were very, very lucky to speak to Ken Kelly, who was the engineer of Rumours, and Ellen Foley, who sang on Paradise by the Dashboard Light. So when we try and do these anniversary episodes, sometimes it just makes it all that more special, all that more of a celebration if we can do something like that. And I'm really excited to confirm that Martin Turner, founding member and bass player of Wishbone Ash, will also be helping us celebrate 50 years of Argus by coming on the show to talk about his memories and his reflections as this album turns 50 years old. So, you know, it's an episode not to be missed. Martin's an absolute character as well. It was just so much fun to chat with him and just to get his perspective really on, you know, this album turning 50 years old and what that feels like for him. So we've got Dan Morris from Firekind and we've also got Martin Turner from Wishbone Ash. However, what I'd also like to do, as we usually do in an anniversary episode, this is the call to arms bit. I want to hear your thoughts on this album. It is truly a classic. Get in touch wherever you keep in touch with the show. So get yourself to Facebook, My Classic Album with Mike Norris. Get yourself to Instagram, My Classic Album Podcast, or follow us on Twitter at @MCA_podcast. And just let me know your thoughts on this album. Maybe you have been listening to it for the last 30, 40, 50 years, or maybe this episode is flagging with you that this is an album I need to check out. Either way, let me know your thoughts on the album. You can also, if you go to myclassicalbum.co.uk and click the contact page, you can also send an email directly to me as well, if you prefer to do it that way. Absolutely fine. Whichever way you want to do it is totally fine. What I'm also going to be doing in the next few weeks, so this might be something that I'll mention again in a future episode, but there will be a vote goes up at some point where people can vote for their favourite song from Argus. So it could be Warrior, it could be Blowing Free, it could be Time Was, whatever your favourite track is from that album, that's your chance to kind of speak out. And we did this with the Nirvana episode last year and it worked really well. I'm going to get some of my fellow podcasters as well to share their thoughts on Argus. So that's what makes these anniversary episodes so special. And yeah, you know, Argus, it's maybe not sold as much as a Nevermind or Hysteria or Night of the Opera, but it's a hugely, hugely influential album and one that I'm really looking forward to celebrating 50 years of here on My Classic Album. But that's in just a few weeks' time. Let's get back to today. My very special guests from UK-based southern rock band Sons of Liberty are the fantastic guitar duo of Fred Hale and Andy Moose Muse. Before we get to my conversation with them all about Lynyrd Skynyrd's debut album, let's just have a look at the facts. He's the beginning of what you need to know about pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd. Released on the 13th of August 1973, pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd is the debut album from southern rock band Lynyrd Skynyrd. After 10 years in the live circuit, Skynyrd attracted the attention of producer Al Cooper, who signed the band to MCA Records. With a decade of experience and great songs under their belt, Lynyrd Skynyrd entered the studio with Cooper to record what would become their debut album. While Gimme Three Steps was released as a single to promote the album, it didn't light up the singles charts. However, in 1974, following the success of Skynyrd's next album, Second Helping, Pronounced's closing track, Freebird, was released as a single, reaching number 19 in the US and number 21 in the UK. Already well on its way to becoming a rock classic, the Freebird single certified platinum in the UK and solidified its status as one of the most requested and loved songs in music history. Pronounced saw significant commercial success, particularly with it being a debut album for the band. The album reached number 27 on the US Billboard 200 and peaked at number 44 on the UK album charts. As the band's success grew and the album's influence became more apparent, Pronounced would go on to certify silver in the UK and double platinum in the US. Pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd is seen by many as the birth of southern rock and an extremely important and influential album for the genre. Rolling Stone named the band's debut number 381 amongst their 500 greatest albums on their latest 2020 list. Meanwhile, Classic Rock magazine ranked Pronounced as the 23rd greatest rock album of all time in 2001. So that's just the beginning of everything we need to know about Pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd. And I have here with me my very special guests who chose the album to discuss today on My Classic Album. From Sons of Liberty, we have Fred and Moose. How's it going?
Damn good, Mike. Thanks for having us on.
Yeah, no worries at all. I mean, obviously the first question that we always kind of ask at the start, at the top of the show here, why have you chosen Pronounced Lynyrd Skynyrd to talk about on My Classic Album today?
Well, we spend hours in a van together talking about music and great albums, but we started out as a southern rock band, and this album really is the first of the genre, and it's just such a, you know, it's amazing to think all back, you know, all the way back then, that, I mean, there's so many songs that, you know, I think the whole first side of the album is still in their set, you know. It's ridiculous. They're wonderful songs that everyone knows, you know, everyone hears them every few days, you know. So it's just incredible to think they produced that as their very first album.
Yeah, for us as, you know, being sort of, I don't know, exponents of the sort of southern rock genre, it's, you know, as Freddie said, it's a total inspiration to us in terms of our own songwriting as we've progressed further forward. But back in the early days of the band, you know, this was very much a go-to album that we sort of came to and lifted a few songs from to play in our set even. So, yeah, and, you know, to think 1973, you know, how many bands go back that far and still have, you know, three or four songs from the from their debut album still in their sets. You know, it's kind of, it's quite amazing, really.
Yeah, this is it. And I mean, obviously, it'll be fun to hear some of those stories about you performing some of these tracks. And you've obviously got a lot of memories of kind of playing it, listening to it together on the road. What are your individual memories of hearing it for the first time?
I think my then girlfriend, who's now my wife, had a sort of cassette of the best of the Golden Platinum in the car. So I remember hearing all these songs, you know, way back. Everyone knew Freebird, and you know, you just know Freebird. You know, it's a huge song, but the other songs on there. So my first memories are in a Ford Escort Estate with a cassette of these songs coming out.
Back in the day, I tended to come to most of these bands from live albums. So I actually started with One More from the Road, and then kind of backtracked to the studio albums that created the set that was on that double album, you know what I mean? So I think I remember buying this like in a Woolworths in Hartcliffe in Bristol, you know, nearby where I used to live, and obviously, you know, inspired by three or four of the songs that were in the live set on the live album kind of thing. As well, as Freddie said, I mean, Freebird was kind of played as the closing song at every rock club, rock night that I went to around that kind of time.
Yeah, you know? Good point. So, it was the closing song that we used to go to the Granary in Bristol, you know, back in late 70s and into the 80s, and it was always the last song. So it was the grab a granny song at the end of the night, you know, and then you let each other go and do some headbanging at the end when it kicked up.
I mean, it's like you say, obviously, in terms of that kind of southern rock as a genre, this is almost, in some ways, this is almost the beginning of it. It's almost kind of ground zero, if you like. You know, what impact, obviously, it's clearly had a huge impact on you guys growing up and you loving music. In terms of Sons of Liberty, what impact have Lynyrd Skynyrd had on you as a band?
I think before Skynyrd, you know, the Allman Brothers band were the sort of big band, but very kind of free form and almost sort of jazzy in a way. And Skynyrd really took the kind of mixed that sort of southern country blues, and they were heavily inspired by the kind of British invasion, you know, bands like Yardbirds, Eric Clapton, they loved, as well as the American bands and the old blues kind of legends. So it was the first band really to add those edgy sort of Alan Collins guitars to that swampy southern bluesy thing, and it's that and the lyrics, you know, the lyrics really are what define southern rock to me. They're about, you know, the lyrics on this album, you know, most of them are real stories that happened to the band. They're very real, and they're ordinary kind of blue collar people, so you can relate to them. They're not fanciful, they're not about Dungeons and Dragons or, you know, all sorts of grand fiction. They're stories of ordinary people, and they really resonate. So I think, I mean, the lyrics are just incredible.
Yeah, and that migrates, you know, completely to Sons of Liberty. I mean, Rob especially is a storyteller, and his song contribution to the band is all about pulling out that kind of earthy, real, you know, sort of heart on your sleeve type stories that are very similar to, you know, some of the things on this first album. So it's quite interesting to see. I mean, obviously Ronnie Van Zant was the only person that wrote every single song on this album, you know, so clearly that was lyrics and probably melodies, but definitely lyrics. The main storytelling element has come from Ronnie. But the other thing for us, I mean, it's kind of, you know, the way they progressed as a band, I think, over their career, and even, you know, since the plane crash and stuff, has really resonated with us, you know, the slightly harder edged kind of southern stuff that they came up with later. But all of that was kind of grounded on this particular album and, you know, and some of those kind of songs. And, you know, the studio they used, the producer, the kind of the whole story of how it all came together, I think is quite amazing. And some of that has kind of parallels with our band as well, you know, so it's quite a leap really sometimes.
I mean, as we've said, I think what makes this album all the more impressive is that it is a debut album, you know, released in 73, but the seeds of Lynyrd Skynyrd, they'd been around for nearly 10 years at this point. You know, the those core members of Ronnie Van Zant that we talked about, Alan Collins and Gary Rossington starting out as 3/5 of kind of the first name was the Noble Five before these kind of various name changes and band members throughout the 60s. How important would you say that core is of Van Zant, Collins and Rossington, who by the time Pronounced comes out, like we say, they've had nearly 10 years to gel as a unit.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, it is interesting because, you know, clearly around this time, they were quite fluid in terms of, you know, they had a few members come and a few members go, you know, so you think the couple of guys from Blackfoot, you know, were in the band as these songs were being written. You know, none of these obviously came out of those particular sessions, but on the kind of, on the reworked, remastered versions that you can pick up, you know, the first and last album, for example, you know, there's a couple of tracks from this era that, you know, I've got Ricky Medlock playing drums and singing and contributing to songwriting, Greg T. Walker. So there's, you know, it's a melting pot of 6 or 7 amazing musicians, you know, and everybody forgets Ed King, you know, came in at the last minute and there he is kind of, you know, picking up, you know, one songwriting credit, but, you know, again, kind of a cool different sound somehow with the Strat that he played and what have you. You know,
he played bass on the album, actually.
Exactly. Yeah.
Because the bass player got cold feet, didn't he, as they went in to record it. And
again, I think there's all those stories, isn't there? It's kind of like people in, people out, and nobody really knows kind of who's left on the versions that have been released. And I think that's why there have been quite a few different versions. And so, but yeah, 3-guitar band, keyboard player as well. You know, it's kind of, you know, obviously they had 2 drummers at one point. It's kind of a bit like the Allman Brothers, and all of that led to, you know, Muscle Shoals and coming out with this cool thing. You know, it's totally amazing, really.
I mean, Classic Rock Review, they explain how, you know, the Noble Five or whatever they were called at the time adopted that, the iconic name that we know them by now. So in 1970, the band changed their name to Leonard Skinner as a tongue-in-cheek tribute to a strict phys ed teacher at their high school in Jacksonville who constantly harassed them because of their long hair. The more distinctive spelling was adopted at the suggestion of Al Cooper, in 1972 when he signed the band to his Sounds of the South, a subsidiary of MCA Records. And, you know, it's obviously it's a name that no one forgets, even though obviously the name of this album acknowledges that, you know, people are going to look at this and be like, how do I pronounce this? Like, hard, what's going on here?
When it actually is on the album cover.
Well, it's a funny story with that because I was obviously, you mean, I love this album anyway, but, you know, when I'm preparing for these, obviously I listen to them a lot more while I'm not just doing the research, but, you know, just carrying on with my day. And I was driving last night and I was trying to get Siri to find this album, which proved very difficult. And in the end, it said something like playing pronounced Linder, Cinder, or something like that. It was just one of those moments where I was just like, yeah, so maybe in that sense, maybe it's not translated as well. But I've always loved the name of the album.
Everyone calls it pronounced, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've talked a little bit about Al there. He was taken by the band from the moment he first saw them live. And he told the following story at the Classic Rock magazine about the bond he established with them early on. So he said, it took me 3 months of hounding their manager to sign them. Towards the end of the 3 months, Ronnie called me at home late one night. Al, I'm sorry to call so late, but we're in deep trouble. Someone broke into our van last night and stole all our instruments and amps. Without those, we can't put food on our family's tables or pay our rents or get any gigs. I was hoping you could lend us $5,000. I quickly replied, all I need is the address you want me to send it to, Ronnie, and you'll have it in 2 days. After a moment of silence, he said, Al, you've just bought yourself a band for $5,000. Thanks from all of us. And, you know, obviously, it's like you say that, you know, this were a band that have just got so many amazing stories behind them. I mean, beyond making sure they had money to put food on the table, how integral is Al Cooper in the story of Leonard Skinner?
Yeah, well, very, very integral. I mean, obviously, later on, the working for the MCA stuff didn't quite go so well, so they obviously had a favour at some point. Yeah, and I was reading a bit of stuff up ahead of this interview, and it sounds like Al Cooper didn't want Tuesdays Gone on the album. Is that right?
Yeah. That's right,
And absolutely. Ronnie took him out and made him sit in the car whilst they went in and recorded it, according to Ronnie. So, yeah, obviously they had quite an interesting relationship even back then with the first album.
Yeah, and that resonates greatly with us as well. I mean, here we are. We've got, 8 tracks on the album, 40-odd minutes or something, and there's two sort of ballads, and then there's one that's a mega sort of ballad into a guitar solo type track, you know. So yeah, I mean, I could see those kind of conversations going down like today, you know. That's a very current thing where the producer wants an album to be a particular shape, you know, with a feel, with a few singles, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know. So yeah, precursor to those arguments going on even back in 1972, yeah, I mean, 73.
It was Simple Man, wasn't it? It was Simple Man they didn't want to record. The second song on the album, 7.5 minutes long. But it was different back then, I guess. Albums were albums, yes. The pressure on singles. But yeah, I mean, Al Kooper, I mean, again, yeah, he did say that, you know, they were so well prepared when they came in. I think he was surprised by that. Mm-hmm. I think Ronnie was a real hard perfectionist, a bit of a taskmaster, wasn't he? And I think he could be quite difficult. So, yeah, I wonder how that relationship actually did work in real life, you know, in history.
I mean, obviously, we talked a little bit about Ed King a few minutes ago, and as you were saying, you know, their bassist, Leon Wilkinson, he got a bit of cold feet, left the group temporarily, and that's kind of when they drafted in Ed, who formerly played with Strawberry Alarm Clock. Ed, you know, he would become part of this kind of sort of like triple threat on guitar with the band. Obviously, as we'd said on this album, he's primarily on bass. Does that have an impact on the sound? Like, does it feel very different to have Ed on bass as opposed to kind of the later albums where he's on guitar?
Yeah, I mean, Ed's got that country chicken picking thing going on that the other two, you know, Gary Rossington's sort of laid back slide and sleazy chords, and Alan's definitely the rocker, isn't he? Yeah. So three really different style guitar players. And certainly, yeah, you can hear in some of the music later on that where Ed had more of an influence, that kind of country, really fast, you know, ridiculously, incredibly talented player. Of course, you don't get to hear any of that. I don't think there's any of it on this album. So it's all Gary and Alan. But yeah, so that kind of flavour came in, but it didn't make the band sound different on the next albums, did it? Just gave them something else. So, yeah, I mean, just the chances of putting a band together in, you know, Jacksonville and finding three world-class different guitarists that all gel together is phenomenal. It's just part of the wonder of Lynyrd Skynyrd.
Yeah, there was clearly something in the water in that part of Florida for sure.
So. Whiskey, I think.
Yeah. that's it. Most of the water was turned into bourbon, and that seemed to fuel the whole thing. So. I managed to make a trip there a few years ago and went and visited, you know, Ronnie's grave and stuff. It was quite emotional. I mean, Jacksonville itself was, you know, it's clearly a working class community kind of thing. You know, it was quite strange actually making a visit there for a few nights.
I mean, with Bob Burns on drums, the album lineup was completed with Billy Powell on keyboards. And I've got a really nice little passage from the book Whiskey Bottles and Brand New Cars. Biographer Mark Grabowski recalls kind of how Billy ended up in the band. So he said, by now, Billy Powell had gotten the promotion he'd been waiting for. For a time, as he carried out his job as a roadie, it seemed as if the band had forgotten that they had a classically trained pianist in their camp. Then after a Skynyrd concert at the Balls School in Jacksonville, Powell dropped onto a piano stool in the auditorium, began noodling a keyboard embellishment for Freebird. Ronnie, hearing it, was taken aback. You play? You've been working with us for a year and you didn't tell us you played? A few more bars and he was in the band, a move that would have a profound effect on the Skynyrd sound. And I guess that's a good question, you know, what does that bring to? I mean, obviously, that keyboard, like that keyboard embellishment on Freebird is just perfect. Oh,
absolutely. Like, yeah. I mean, you know, especially as it's, you know, there's lots of piano as well, isn't it? You know, whereas keyboards around this time with a lot of other bands would have been, you know, organ, Hammond, kind of very first synthesizers that were not really electronic at this stage, you know, but having that lovely, you know, like you say, running piano kind of theme things going on as a complement to two or three guitar parts, you know, it's just incredible really how the song structures have been put together, and you know how much of that, you know, obviously it's in the writing clearly, but Al Kooper probably had quite a bit to do with pulling some of that together, you know, in terms of, you know, the way some of these songs are structured.
I know you talked a little bit before there about Muscle Shoals and kind of some of the work that they did there. I know that wasn't released for quite a few years after this album was released. How do you feel the songs evolved between kind of what we hear on unpronounced, and obviously what came before in those Muscle Shoals sessions.
Yeah, well, I think there's a couple of songs on this album that nobody's heard, unless you've got the album, but you never hear. And you can hear that, you know, they're kind of quite Southern blues based and fairly typical kind of, they're played very much in the Skinner style, and the great songs, but they don't stand out in that unique way that the more, you know, the classic songs that we all remember from the album and listen to time and again, they kind of dropped some of that stuff. Yeah. So you can hear that, you know, that's a debut album, isn't it? It's them finding their feet. You know, they didn't know which songs were going to be
hits or successful.
Think any of them would be. And I think the production quality, this was Studio One, wasn't it, in Georgia, this album. And obviously the production quality and the Swampers and the atmosphere at Muscle Shoals was probably a notch up in terms of quality back in the day. Yeah. So I think the production quality, definitely improved. Yeah. And they probably had a lot more time in the studio and on production and pre-production and everything, you know, having had a kind of, you know, platinum album or whatever it was. So it's you can hear the kind of quality kicking up in the, but that creativeness for so many great songs on this album, you know, they did do it again and again and again. But this is their debut album. It's ridiculous. It's just ridiculous.
It really is. I mean, obviously, to jump back to that kind of the sort of the pronounced sessions, for lack of a better word, you know, obviously that with that lineup or the core lineup being together for so many years, you know, they had like 14 tracks demoed, which they were able to narrow down to the 8 that make up this album. Al Cooper would produce the album. He famously reflected on the sessions. I know you'd said before he talked about how taken aback about how professional they were. He called the band years ahead of their time. He said they were 20-year-olds playing like 30-year-olds. Yeah. He called them the best damn arrangers I've ever worked with. They understood music organically and not by the book. That must come. So again, you know, we have said a few times kind of what a fantastic, you know, it's got to be up there with one of the greatest debut albums of all time. Do you think a lot of that's just around, obviously, just the sheer amount of experience they all had on the live circuit in various forms and getting the chance to evolve these songs over the previous 10 years?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, they you know, clearly they've been gigging, they played these songs live many times before going in studio. You know, the whole, you know, the evolution of the, you know, maybe over the 2 years prior to the sessions actually taking place, you know, you can see on some of the re-releases and things where demo tracks have been included as well, how the leap from demo to final has been made. And in some cases it's not massive, but it, you know, it just adds that little bit of nuance that kind of just makes it such a classic song rather than just a good song or a great song, you know what I mean? So I think that the work, you know, and most bands, you know, their first album has normally had a lot of time put into it, you know, because it tracks the kind of, you know, a formation of a band coming together, finding its feet. And, you know, it probably applies for, I don't know, Deep Purple or something, or as much as it does for Skinnerd. But, you know, like Freddie said, the fact that they could then carry on and, you know, Second Helping's got some great tracks on it, and, you know, 4 or 5 albums. And of course they're banging them out in, you know, sub 12 month kind of gaps for the next sort of 3 or 4 years, which is quite amazing, really. So they clearly found a way of working together as a team somehow, you know, be it small groups within the group, and then add in the final piece of the magic when they all came together to actually do the final recording.
I think it was also, you know, such a creative period in music, because they were pioneers, and they weren't influenced by, you know, too much by sort of copying anyone. It's much harder these days because there's so much, it's, you know, it's hard to find that originality, but it clearly was coming from somewhere quite deep, because, you know, their blues influence, they didn't sound like anybody. And bands, you know, back then, you know, with the advent of recording in the way it was, and you know, cranking up the guitars, had this sort of bit of a blank canvas to work on, and you can hear that in how creative the sounds and how it's sort of out there, you know, those long guitar solos. I don't think anyone was doing that before then. I mean, there was sort of rambling jazz and blues stuff, but not in rock music. So it was clearly coming from just that unique mixture of them, the environment they were in, the influences around them, just create, you know, really creative.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, as the session started to wind up, so Ronnie was getting more and more increasingly convinced that Ed King would be better served as a guitarist in the band rather than on bass duties. And he managed to convince Leon to rejoin the band just in time for the album cover to be taken as well. So obviously that doesn't affect what we hear on Pronounced, but it does solidify that infamous kind of three guitar army that Skinhead would become renowned for. I mean, obviously, you guys are in a band, obviously, where there's two guitarists, and that's pretty a much more common thing now than perhaps it was sort of in the 70s. But do you think that kind of, that three guitar army kind of sound, has that had an influence on the way that you two kind of interact in the band and live and in the studio?
We're probably not a great example of that. If you've got two guitars, you don't want them doing the same thing. You get three's probably excessive.
Yeah, especially with a keyboard player as well. We're obviously a classic twin guitar, straight ahead five-piece rock band kind of thing. That kind of one guitar with keyboards or two guitars with keyboards, that's starting to become a bit over the top. But in this instance, three guitars and keyboards. It's quite mad, really. Sometimes you might get a musician who, play keyboards and guitar kind of thing, hop between the two, especially for live. But like you say, it's more of a orchestra than a kind of rock band almost, even though.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit, it's kind of Iron Maiden are doing that now, aren't they? They've got three, and they're all lead guitarists. They're not, it's not Angus Young and Malcolm Young. They've all got amazing kind of chops and lead chops as well as rhythm.
Yeah.
So it's, I think there's more maybe space in that kind of music as well in the Skinnery stuff for some of those subtle differences. There's obviously still going out with three. Molly Hatchet had three, didn't they, for a while, and it's kind of that it was less distinction there. They were all full-on rockers. So I think that really worked for Skinner because of the three very different styles, different guitars. Just the use of the Les Paul against the Strat or the Telecaster, you get those different kind of tones, which we don't enjoy that. We tend to be cranking out a couple of Les Pauls by day now, so we're not very subtle.
I think the Maiden comparison is an interesting one because they were in my head as well when we were talking about kind of like a trio of guitars, and I think it's still now like. It's still quite a unique thing, isn't it? Like the idea of having three guitarists, even, obviously, like we say, Maiden are doing that. But I think that was only because they didn't have the heart to chuck one out when Adrian returned. So it's just like,
nothing against this Yannick, isn't it?
But, yeah.
Spare part, to be honest. Musically, he spins around too much. and you're talking to a very, prolific spinner. Sorry, Aaron, I will never get, we never get any support for Maiden anyway.
No.
But obviously the album came out in August 73, and when it did, Pronounced was very well received immediately upon release. I think just with it being, as we say, such a trailblazing album, and thanks to Al Cooper being close friends with Pete Townsend, Skinhead swiftly then went on to support The Who on their US tour.
Quadrophenia, wasn't it?
Quadrophenia
tour. Yeah. So it's quite an amazing thing to, that fit just doesn't seem right at all, does it? Them going out with a concept and there's these working class kind of rednecky guys, just crazy, really. But they clearly benefited from that, didn't they? Exposure to a large audience right from the very start did them very well,
Unfortunately, it would only be 4 years after the release of this album. We've touched on it a couple of times so far that obviously the tragedy would befall the Classic lineup as Ronnie Van Zant and five other passengers would die in a devastating plane crash, with many of the band suffering, I think all of the band suffering injuries. Severe injury. I mean, knowing Ronnie, he wasn't even 30, and obviously there's a song that kind of always makes me think of that, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. But, after that acknowledgement that he was taken from us far too soon, where do you think that Pronounced sits within his legacy and the legacy of the band?
It's up there, isn't it? I mean, it's kind of, it's hard to detach. There's definitely that, pre-plane crash kind of thing. And there's a group of people who don't even consider Skinner to be, you know, the current Skinner to be Skinnered even, you know, which is kind of crazy in a way. But yeah, it always makes me wonder, you know, these people that are taken from us too early, what would they have been doing now kind of thing, you know, how would they have, you know, like the same with like Randy Rhoads or with, you know, with Dwayne Allman or something, you know, it's kind of, you're left with this little snapshot of time and this, that, just what if, you know, you never quite know.
Yeah, I think it does, it makes some of the lyrics very poignant and you know, it adds to the massively tragic events, but it does add to the emotion of the album because you get a sense of the person. Really, obviously Ronnie was on this album, Steve Gaines and Cassie Gaines weren't, where they, you know, on the later stuff. But, you know, that, you know, Simple Man or Free Bird, you listen to the lyrics and you can, it's so open. You can see into his soul, I think. And that's, so I think it does add to the kind of emotion around listening to these songs.
Let's dive in track by track. As we've said, you know, I mean, there's only eight tracks on the album, but I mean, they're all fantastic and some undisputed, you know, stone cold classics. Yeah. You know, on this one. So we'll start with I Ain't the One, our opening track. Society of Rock called the song a cold killer of an album opener. Clocks in at just under 4 minutes. Tells the story of a man determined to leave a woman after finding out that she's overdue and planning a shotgun wedding, even though he isn't the child's father. I mean, what are your thoughts on I Ain't the One? I mean, obviously, when I'd called it a cold killer of an album, you know, it sounded like you were kind of in agreement with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a cracking opener. I mean, it's got this sort of weird backward drummy thing at the start, isn't it? And then it just rips in, and it's instant Skinnered.
Yeah.
It sounds like, mm-hmm. It sounds like a lot of the later albums and a lot of the classics that are not on this album that we all know. Yeah, that it just captures. Yeah. It captures the rockier side of Skinner immediately.
And great storytelling as well, isn't it? You know, it's kind of, you know, where this story came from, you know, who knows? You know, is it somebody?
It's got it. I mean, they're all real, aren't they? Yeah, all of these stories are there. It's and it probably is something, you know, everything on here has happened to Ronnie, or he's seen it happen, or it's happened to someone in his family.
I mean, you talked a bit about that backward percussion effect that's kind of going on. Classic Rock Review had a little bit of criticism for the opening track, kind of singling that out, saying the album begins with some backward percussion effects. They introduce I Ain't the One. Although this intro is rather awkward, the song finally catches its groove with the Rossington riff and piano embellishment from Powell, saving the song from being too ordinary. Do you think that's kind of harsh criticism? Or do you think
it's too harsh? They're just being creative, aren't they? You could... That's all you could do back then was move the tape around and it was all obviously done on sort of 2-inch tape back then. So that was the pinnacle of effects, or you were sort of hanging a bathtub upside down and clanging it with a donkey or something. At least it hasn't got that on.
I mean, I Ain't the One, it was famously performed by the band on the Old Grey Whistle Test here in the UK for our international listeners. Society of Rock praised the performance with a twin guitar attack from Gary Rossington and Alan Collins, who, by the way, delivers a solo right around a minute and a half that can only be described as absolutely scorching. I Ain't the One proves to be one of the most standout performances to come across the Old Grey Whistle Test stage. It's equal parts Southern Rock and something uniquely Lynyrd Skynyrd, oozing attitude, little bit of humour and a whole lot of talent. It sounds like you've seen that performance. I think, to be fair, like Old Grey Whistle Test have had some that show had some amazing performances. So to single this one out as one of the best, I think it means it must be a must see.
It was great to see them on. I guess we've all watched those episodes over and over again throughout our lifetime, and obviously, you know, massively helped them reach the status that they did in the UK very quickly as well as a live band and a touring band, and they've always they still retain that relationship with the UK, and I think the Old Grey Whistle Test sessions are just, and yes, they're so good.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favourite tracks coming up next, which we've talked about a couple of times already, so Tuesday's Gone, one of many tracks on this album that's become a staple for the band. I know you'd said right at the start there's four or five of these songs that are still in the set list to this day. Why do you think Tuesday's Gone has resonated with us so much over what's been nearly 50 years now?
Yeah, it's
a masterful.
Yeah, it's got such a vibe in it. It really is. Yeah,
Yeah, it's, I mean, in any genre, it's a great song. I mean, it's a song that, you know, R&B artists could do, or a pop band could do, or it's just a great, great song. And again, you know, you can tell it's coming from somewhere quite deep. You know, it's all real in the lyrics and the story behind it. But musically, it's stunning. It's just the arrangement is, you know, and we did, you know, we tried to play.
Yeah,
this.
We did a couple of times. Didn't
we were doing covers back in the early days.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I loved playing it, but it's, you know, there's nothing in this arrangement which is obvious. Yeah. And you don't notice it listening to it, I don't think. But if you try and play it, it's a very clever song. Yeah. It's really musically mature. It's, yeah, wonderful melodies.
I mean, website the Quad have a lot of praise for this song. They call it a mournful farewell. They say Tuesday's Gone paints the sad portrait of leaving a loved one. Van Zandt's narrator bids a farewell to his wife as he approaches the unknown aboard a train, leaving her gone with the wind. The instrumentation behind this ballad is nothing short of heart-wrenching, with the perfect balance of electric guitar backed by the Mellotron strings. And I'd agree with that. I think that use of the Mellotron. So again, we're talking about these embellishments that kind of, from having kind of keyboard and Mellotron and these kinds of things, you know, that Mellotron behind the guitar is an absolute masterstroke,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
In this.
Yeah. It's great, isn't it?
I mean, interestingly, this is the only track on the album where Bob Burns isn't behind the kit. That's the band drafted in Robert Nix from Atlanta Rhythm Section to play drums on Tuesday's Gone. Is it noticeable that Bob's not there? I think for me, obviously, one of the strengths of this, and like, it's like you're saying, there's a lot going on this song that, you know, it's maybe a little bit subtle. Diving into this song, the drums are fantastic on this track. Do you think that's not a dig at Bob Burns, but is it noticeable?
I think it's a waltz, isn't it?
I think
it's a waltz. Yeah, so it's it's kind of a classic-y feel to the song. Yeah, I didn't know, you know, until we knew we were doing this, I hadn't done my research on the album. I've just listened to it. Yeah, I found that nugget of information. And I guess it is that Jess maybe the waltz thing that they you know, he might have been in a
more of a function band kind of thing, club
band or something, and they felt that, you know, that just shows how detailed and how much of a perfectionist the band
was. Absolutely,
were.
Yeah. I mean, that's a brave
and Al Cooper,
a brave move, isn't it? I mean, you know, just put yourself in the position of Bob and being part of that conversation. You know, you're finally recording your debut album with your band you've been with for a little while, and then hold on a minute, I'm not going to be on one of these tracks. It's like, you know, that would be an incredibly difficult thing to do under most circumstances. But yeah, it just showed, you know, probably that is, you know, Ronnie and Al Cooper cracking the whip there to get the feel of the track absolutely spot on. And like you say, with the magical musicianship and arrangements of the rest of the guys playing, I think it probably would have been missed if it had been something a bit more simple.
And I think it's something about, you know, these decisions that they're making, like you say, clearly they make these decisions and it's what best serves the song.
Yeah,
and I think that's something that certainly a strength of this album, that they're not afraid to do that. Tuesday's Gone, famously covered by Metallica, appeared on the Garage Inc. album. That particular track also includes appearances from the likes of Les Claypool from Primus, Jerry Cantrell, Pepper Keenan, and many more. It's actually like an all-star band kind of performing it. What do you make of Metallica's rendition? Because I think anyone who maybe hasn't heard it before would probably be in for a bit of a shock.
It's kind of I must admit, I'm a great fan of kind of digging out these weird cover versions of songs, and you know, I've got quite an extensive iTunes playlist of just cover versions, and you know, and it is interesting to see where, like you say, some slightly different field musicianship takes a song, but the song still shines through. You know what I mean? It's kind of, you know, even with different tunings or very different sounding guitars and things, it's kind of, you know, especially those, you know, this Metallica, very simple kind of production, you know, not very produced. I think it actually said on the on the cover of those, it's kind of, you know, they clearly just bashed it out for a bit of fun and thought, okay, well, this actually sounds quite good. And but yeah, for me, it's still, you know, the song's got to kind of still shine through somehow for those things to really work, you know.
I mean, the song, you know, obviously you know, kind of preaching to the choir here a little bit. It's been a huge influence on bands that have followed, not least one of my favorite, well, I say one of my favorite groups at the moment, probably my absolute favorite group at the moment, Blackstone Cherry. Lead singer Chris Robertson said about Tuesday's Gone, "Even when I was a kid, that song just evoked a feeling in me that I could never describe. Still to this day, that song makes me cry. Whenever we play with Skinhead and they do that, that song puts tears in my eyes." And I think it's just testament to the power of this song so many years on that, you know, obviously this is a band who have had huge, you know, huge international success themselves. But, you know, hearing that song, be it Skinhead playing it or hearing it on the radio, that takes you back to being a fan again. It takes you back to being a music lover again.
Yeah, it's the beauty of, you know, great songs, and they have a life of their own, and they touch the soul, and you know, that attention to detail and that, so just a passion about the music. I mean, it's incredible. Yeah, I haven't heard the Metallica version, I don't think, so I won't comment on that. Okay. But I will. I'll have to go and listen to it. But and Blackstone Cherry, they've got that kind of passion about the music as well, haven't they? It's comes across. It's real,
and they've got that kind of like family connection back to the old stagers of kind of southern rock music as well, haven't they? So you know you can see, like you say, Chris, with, you know, the connections back through to the Kentucky Headhunters and what have you, know, using old cabins in the Kentucky woods somewhere, you know, very reminiscent of how this album was pulled together properly, you know, kind of lots of drinking and kind of late nights and dark rooms, and from it something magical comes, you know.
I'm always going to enjoy a conversation where I managed to rope it back to Blackstone Cherry. I even mentioned them at the top of the show. If anyone's listened to this and, you know, they're looking for more current southern rock bands, obviously Sons of Liberty are absolutely a go-to. I'm going to play a track by them shortly. But also, if you've yet to have the pleasure, Blackstone Cherry. And I mean, I've talked about them a few times on the show. We've had Boone Froggatt, who's part of another fantastic band called Otis. They're good friends with the Blackstone Cherry guys, another fantastic southern rock band. So, you know, southern rock is very much alive and well. There's some amazing bands, amazing singers out there. Pronounce Lynyrd Skynyrd is the start of that, and that's why it's such a special album. So we'll get back to our little conversation in just a little bit. You know, as I said, if you've got any thoughts on this, if you've got any thoughts on anything that you want to talk about, perhaps you want to share your thoughts on Argus, as I was talking about earlier, or just anything really, absolutely get on the social media pages. So My Classic Album with Mike Norris on Facebook, My Classic Album Podcast on Instagram, @MCA_podcast on Twitter. And all this information, keep yourself up to date with My Classic Album. It's all up on www.myclassicalbum.co.uk. But last year, Sons of Liberty released their latest album, Aces and Hates. And as I'd said, you know, southern rock is alive and well, and Sons of Liberty are an amazing example of that. Here is a pretty appropriate song, I think, in the times that we're living at the moment, but a highlight from their album, Aces and Hates, that was released last June. Here are Sons of Liberty with I Come in Peace.
Got no agenda, got nothing to hide, no need to learn now, and I tell you why. The path we walk is the one we choose. It's better to give now than it is to lose. Be indifferent,
Let's move on to Gimme Three Steps. So, I mean, you'd said it's very likely that all of these songs are kind of based on real events, and, you know, be they Ronnie or people that he knew or stories that he told. This is allegedly based on an incident where he had a gun pulled on him for dancing with a girl in a biker bar. Obviously brings the tempo back up after Tuesday's Gone. Do you think, you know, and I think this is something that's maybe lost kind of in modern day, you know, do you think it's important kind of in terms of the flow of the album and the journey we go on that we bring the tempo back up at this
point? Oh, definitely. And you know, we tried to do that live as well, you know, that kind of ebb and flow kind of thing. You know, on a vinyl album with four tracks on each side, it's, you know, it's bloody hard to do, you know, it's kind of to get that kind of pacing and song length and stuff correct. So, yeah. So, you know, for me, this is a great lift at this point, you know, killer riff to bring the song in and a great story, you know, hey there, fella, with your hair colored yellow, all that stuff, you know, it's kind of such a great song and clearly great fun, kind of tongue in cheek story as well. You know, it is clearly. Yeah. Well,
it's another real one, isn't it? It is, yeah, because the bar exists, doesn't it? And they renamed it The Jug, because it wasn't called The Jug, but in the lyrics it is called The Jug, and it's actually now called The Jug.
You'd have to, wouldn't you?
You'd have to. Well, yeah, and obviously you're going to sell more beer, aren't you? Well, this is the bar. Yeah. This is Give Me Three Steps.
I mean, obviously, in terms of that story, so this is Gary Rossington's version of events from Song Facts. So he said that Ronnie had used a fake ID to get in a bar while he and Alan Collins waited for him in a truck. Ronnie danced with a girl named Linda, whose boyfriend wasn't too happy about it, came up to Ronnie and reached for something in his boot. Figuring he was going for a gun, Ronnie told him, if you're going to shoot me, it's going to be in the ass or the elbows. Just give me a few steps and I'll be gone. Ran at the truck and then they wrote the song that night. So that's kind of the story of that one anyway.
Brilliant.
Yeah. I mean, by all accounts, you know, there's some pretty wild stories. I'd read something along the lines of that, you know, the band were either getting into bar fights with other people or fighting each other, you know, all of this kind of stuff. Are there any stories that you've read or heard about that kind of stick out for you in particular? Not necessarily from this kind of time in their career, but just sort of generally?
Just generally this, you know, that, yeah, Ronnie can be a bit handy. And
he liked to drink, of course, didn't he, as well? So I think he had a very sort of Jekyll and Hyde kind of characterization, you know, so could be sweet as pie 1 minute and a few drinks later or something, like nudges in the wrong direction and he can go off on one. So, but yeah, you know, I've never got to meet any of the guys personally, but yeah, you know, I think they were all a bit kind of good old country boys that didn't mind a rumble, you know.
It makes me think of, it was last year we did an episode about, I don't know if you've heard any albums by Cactus, but we did One Way or Another by Cactus, and again, very similar kind of background. They're probably more kind of metal leanings than Lynyrd Skynyrd, but some great stories coming out of Cactus's time kind of on the road.
Yeah, I think that, UFO springs to mind as well, doesn't it? It was sort of Phil Mogg was a bit of a live wire for a small fella. But yeah, no, I think I think Schenker left because he got hit him or something, didn't he? So something with singers and small singers.
I mean, Classic Rock Review have strong praise for this one, saying, going as far to say as, aside from Sweet Home Alabama, Give Me Three Steps may be the quintessential Southern rock song of all time. Is that something you'd agree with?
Yeah, we you know, again, we used to play this in the set back in the day, and it was always one of our favourites, you know, other than, you know, as well as Freebird and Alabama, but yeah, there was just something about this, you know, just a killer riff at the beginning, especially, and
it's kind of Southern boogie, isn't it? It's got that boogie thing going on. Some of the sort of biggest epics on the album are just sort of songs. It's got that crossover thing, which defines a lot of Skynyrd and the genre. You know, it's you can hear it in Blackfoot, you can hear it in Molly Hatchet, and you know, some of the other sort of bands that came afterwards. So, yeah, it probably is a defining kind of song.
So we'll move on to another hugely popular track from the album, Simple Man. It's the third most streamed Lynyrd Skynyrd song behind the ones you'd expect, Sweet Home Alabama and Freebird. I mean, bringing things down again, but I think it somehow manages to sound, this almost like subtle, but like powerful at the same time, which is a really difficult balance to strike. I mean, would you say it's a highlight of the album for yourselves?
I know for Rob, it was one of the songs, if not the sort of Skynyrd song that he loved singing when we used to play these songs the most. And I think, you know, it, again, lyrically is wonderful. And I think it's something that everyone either can relate to or wishes they could relate to. They wish they had that conversation with their mum, you know. It's just captures that sort of, you know, working class family sit down thing. So lyrically, I think it's amazing. And musically, it's, you know, and I think, you know, the solo is very simple, but it's gut-wrenchingly powerful. And you know, the choice of notes, it's, you know, big notes, it's not flash, it's just, you know. So I think that, yeah, that kind of gives it that rockier kind of edge when that kicks in. A yeah, really incredibly crafted song, and really, really simple. You know, it's just kind of two parts to the song with this, yeah, really clever. I mean, where does that come from? You know, it's not been done before, is it?
And this one's been covered a few times as well since, hasn't it? You know, so, yeah. Yeah. You know, so for me, Three Steps and Simple Man are probably my, you know, top, hard to pick between those two as in terms of favorite tracks on this album. I mean, even above Freebird, that's probably because Freebird's got that kind of, it's just been, you know, played so many times. And it's kind of, I think as songs, I think Three Steps and Simple Man kind of like both sides of the coin for me, for what sort of Skinner's bringing to the table at this point in their career.
I mean, obviously when you're talking about it being covered kind of many times, which it has, I think one of those most famous covers, again, to bring a more current band into the conversation would be Shinedown. And I know that for many people, I'd say my wife included, I think their first exposure to that song was the Shinedown version of it. You know, what do you make of their rendition? Yeah. It does seem like it's kind of opened the door for a new generation of Skinhead fans to go back and discover this album.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's quite true to the original, I would say. They haven't, you know, changed it around too much. And yeah, it's got modern drum sound and a bit more modern guitar sound perhaps, but yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's the same song, you know, and I think you're right, you know, for in the last 10 years, it's probably opened people's eyes to kind of where that song came from, and hopefully made a few people go back and look at some of the back catalogue stuff, you know, from Skinner themselves.
I mean, obviously the Skinner version, written in remembrance of Ronnie's grandmother who'd passed away, I feel like, and I know you'd said obviously about, you know, what an enjoyable song that is to sing. I think it's a real showcase of his vocals. It's a real opportunity for him to show off. I mean, I think it certainly is on the album. Would you say kind of throughout his career, is this one of his strongest vocal performances?
Yeah, I think it is. It's just emotive. Yeah, he's got a unique kind of, well, and John has got a very similar kind of voice. So I guess the family had a very unique voice. Yeah, it's the range and the, because he's not kind of classical singer, but there's just some quality in there. And I think it just shines massively, you know, in Simple Man. It's lyrically and you know, the melody of the vocals are wonderful.
And we were talking like towards the start of our chat about how Al Cooper wasn't a fan of the song. He was pretty insistent it wasn't going to make it on the album. obviously, you did tell the story. I've got another quote from Whiskey Bottles and Brand New Cars that kind of almost kind of reimagines that for us a little bit. There's been some dispute that this happened, but I'm going to go on record and say that it did, because I love it. So Cooper had said, "You guys are not going to cut that song." Ronnie was not about to argue the point. He took Cooper out to the parking lot and opened the door to Cooper's Bentley. "Get in," he said. "Too petrified to resist, Al slid into the driver's seat. Ronnie, standing outside the open window, had just one thing to say: when we're done cutting it, we'll call you."
I mean, I'd like to believe that as well. I mean, I'd heard that story, and I've always taken it as true, and I want to, so I'm going to.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that shows the confidence, doesn't it? You know, obviously, they've been playing these songs. Simple Man, presumably, was quite a few years old at that time. Yeah. They'll have had in their mind, you know, when we can record an album, when we're going to do this. You know, it's just having that conviction and that confidence in the material they've been playing, isn't it?
Yeah, particularly, I mean, obviously with the vocal performance on there, you can see why he wanted to sing it and why he wanted it on the album. And yeah, time has proven them right, isn't it?
So,
it's done all right.
So we'll flip the record over. We'll open up side two with Things Going On. So the quads say Things Going On takes the fifth slot, provides a southern tone with the bass backing a guitar intro sounding like a classic country song. Yes. Soon, however, the tune adds an upbeat Old West-esque piano element to the chorus. The instrumentation showcases the mastery with which Lynyrd Skynyrd formulates the majority of their songs. Is this a good example? Is it a good shouting showing just how tight they were, I guess? Just so tight and kind of in the pocket.
Yeah, and blending the styles and stuff as well. You know, like you say, kind of shifting around from country, southern blues to kind of, you know, it's kind of, it's a real melting pot of stuff. And, you know, clearly they were fearless in terms of what they were doing. And
yeah, got that kind of big boogie-woogie piano. Billy Powell lets loose. Yeah, you can see that he's been doing that in the bars, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Knocking that out for his whiskey. Yeah, you can see there's like a skiffly beat to it as well. You can see the influences in it a lot more clearly than the previous songs. But yeah, musically, yeah, they're stretching out, aren't they? And the bass is quite spectacular on it as well, really busy. Absolutely. That's a guitar player playing bass, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, the subject matter of the song has attracted a bit of attention over the years, particularly the first line, "Well, have you ever lived down in the ghetto?" As things going on, it's been kind of named in many ways like a protest song lamenting the politicians of the day. At this point, kind of in the early 70s, segregation was still supported by many people in the US, particularly in the southern states. So I guess what kind of hits home with me is to release a song that challenges that political stance. That's a huge risk to do on your debut album.
Yeah, it's again Ronnie all over, isn't it? It's kind of, you know, I mean, even when you think he's kind of calling to one side or the other, he's usually, you know, playing one off against each other or something. So, you know, very clever in his lyrics in terms of, you know, not alienating anybody somehow, even though, okay, he had a couple of run-ins with a few people down the years, other musicians especially. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of, Florida in the early 70s would have been a fairly tricky place to be heading to the ghetto for anything, wouldn't it? You know,
I mean, I shared a bit of criticism for some of the tracks early on. I think it's just fun just to kind of chuck it in and kind of see how we feel about it. It's just a bit of minor criticism for this one from Classic Rock Review. They say things going on at times seems a bit unsure of itself, especially due to its lack of a strong beat. Now, I couldn't really get where they were coming from here, but I thought it was worth asking if you could agree with that opinion or had an idea where it comes from.
I don't think it's unsure of itself, but it is a bit of an eclectic mix of styles, isn't it?
It's got a different feel to it, definitely, to the to any other track on the album, hasn't it? So yeah, maybe that's where they're coming from, but yeah, I think it's, you know, it doesn't make the album any worse, does it?
I mean, we'll move on to Mississippi Kid. So I think this is quite a unique song in terms of songwriting credits on the album. So we've said Ronnie's credited on all of them, but this is Ronnie, Al Cooper, and then Bob Burns on drums. Yeah. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on Mississippi Kid? Does it stand out in any way? And obviously the contributors are maybe a bit different to elsewhere on the album.
I think you have to have somewhere to go to give the album some sort of, make it listenable and variety. And it certainly, again, it's almost got a sort of jug band thing going on, isn't it? But I mean, it gives another dimension to the album, and maybe it's propping up a lot of classics as well.
For me, I'm kind of thinking that this might have been some kind of late night idea where there's just Cooper and Burns in the studio, and they're just goofing off for a bit, you know. And you can see, you know, Cooper encouraging Burns, you know, well, let's try some of this kind of weird stuff and just kind of see where we go with it. And it turned into something that then Ronnie's possibly then heard and thought, hold on a minute, here we go, we can make something of that, you know. But, you know, I don't know, probably musically it's mostly Cooper, isn't it? I guess, you know, drummers writing songs don't happen very often, and normally, and if they do, it tends to be melodies or lyrics, you know. But yeah, very interesting contribution to the album, I would say.
I mean, Bob talked a little bit in an interview in 2002 about the song, and he said, "This is going to tickle everybody's fancy. I didn't write any of the song. There was only a kick drum, maybe some congas and stuff I'll put in there later. There wasn't a drum part to that song." Yeah, so there's somewhat of an irony in
there. You know, he's
on the screen. So isn't it the same in there, a Lizzie song? Is it Boys Are Back in Town or something that Brian Downey gets? And he got given a credit for some reason by Phil Lynott. And so it might be one of those.
He got paid some royalties.
Yeah.
Retirement fund.
He did, however, give the song its name. So he says, I walked in the door and Ronnie said, Bob, what are we going to name this song? I said, Mississippi Kid. I never thought about it. I never had a thought before it or after it. I just said it. They named it that. And Ronnie was so taken. And Al, with what I did, they gave me credit for writing. Okay. So there we go.
No, it's all right. He just paid for his Christmases every year.
Exactly.
Holidays, yeah.
Exactly. So for me, the phrase Mississippi Kid, it has quite an eerie distinction in Skinhead folklore, as despite having little to no connection to the state previously, Ronnie began calling himself the Mississippi Kid. Okay. Now, this scarily foretold that the tragic plane crash that we've been talking about that took his life would happen just outside Gillsburg, Mississippi, also confirming another foretelling that Ronnie would often go around telling people that he wouldn't live to see 30, yeah. And he passed away at 29. So obviously, no connection to the song itself, but obviously it always kind of draws that comparison to me. I think it's just quite sobering to think that these weird kind of predictions, I guess, kind of ultimately came true.
Odd links in there that you can find a link if you look for it hard enough, kind of thing. But
yeah, I think it's a bit of an American thing to do. I'm not a conspiracy theorist, particularly. They do tell it with some conviction, in the storytellers and the biographers.
So we'll move on to Poison Whiskey. So a joint effort with Ronnie and Ed King. So this is Ed King's songwriting credit on the album. Classic Rock Review call it a short, funky song with more use of the nice double guitar harmony by Rossington and Collins. Of course, as we say, Ed plays bass on this album primarily. But do you think, you know, obviously with it being quite a nice guitar-driven song, do you think his prowess on guitar, do you think that informs the song musically because of his kind of songwriting credit, as it were?
Yeah, you would think so, wouldn't you? It's kind of, I'm guessing, he probably brought the riff to the band, I would think, and then they built on it from there. But yeah, I mean, it kind of, it's cool to think some of the songs that he was involved in further down the line, this was the sort of first songwriting credit, if you like. But yeah,
it's got a kind of swampy southern blues thing that you could see that in that kind of style that we heard later on from him. That's what he brought to the party.
I think it's just a really smooth moment. That's the word I've written down. It's like, it's one of my favorite tracks on the album. I really like it. Society of Rock have a lot of praise for it, saying it's a blue-soaked cautionary tale of what too much Johnny Walker Red will do to you. A stone-cold killer of a track, highlighted by dueling organs, slide guitars, and Ronnie Van Zant's glycerin smooth vocal delivery. And yeah, I think it is, maybe, obviously, we've got these big tracks like Simple Man and Free Bird that we're going to talk about. This is probably a bit of a hidden gem, I think. It's one that maybe people should check out if they haven't already.
Yeah, and you can hear this. They've redone this on about three of the albums after this. This is another Blueprint song, a bit like, I think, Give Me Three Steps, that's just become a kind of signature kind of sound for them.
Interesting you should talk about them kind of redoing this. I know one of the renditions that they've done it, along with I Ain't the One and Things Going On, they appeared on Skinhead's 1994 album Endangered Species. Yeah. So we're very much kind of in the Johnny Van Zant era at this point, taking the reins kind of in tribute to Ronnie. What are those acoustic reimaginings like on Endangered Species? I know you said that they kind of come back to this song time and time again. It must be quite interesting hearing Johnny kind of tackle these songs that Ronnie perfected for Pronounced.
Yeah, I mean, some of the songs are very different in that era, and some have just been sort of lifted and shifted, and just like you say, two acoustics or maybe three acoustics on that album. Obviously, must have been a really difficult time for them, wondering what to do. Shall we be putting this band back together to do new stuff going forwards? Without the key member of the band, if you like. I think. Johnny in particular must have found it really difficult. But yeah, I really, again, it's same with cover versions. I quite like the unplugged-y type albums too. So I do pull those tracks out quite often.
I'd say it's worth a listen. And it's not classic, but it is of that. It is, like you say, it reflects what would have been a difficult period for them. And it was it was a stage that, relatively successful when it kept things moving, and that led to some fantastic stuff after that as well. So I think it's important in that way, and it's worth definitely worth a listen. Yeah.
So we'll move on to our final track, the elephant in the room, I guess, in some ways.
We should have done it in reverse, really, should we?
It's like when Metallica toured the Black Album and they did it in reverse so that they did Enter Sandman last instead of doing it first. But yeah, I mean, what can we say about Freebird? You know, it's one of the most famous pieces of music in rock history. Clocking in at just over 9 minutes, a good half of that is obviously this amazing... Yeah. Yeah. I mean, before we delve in too much, what are your initial thoughts on Freebird before we get into it?
I think just an amazing piece of music and you know, the sort of gut-wrenching vocal performance on it. It's just out there, isn't it? It shouldn't work. It shouldn't be that popular according to all of the music industry experts, but it blooming well does. It's incredible. It's huge.
But it's very simple at the same time as well, isn't it? You know, it's got some nice layering and, like you say, the keyboard parts on it as well. But actually, you know, as a song structure, there's nothing complicated going on here, is there? You know, in terms of verses and choruses repeating, telling the story, and then crazy at the end kind of thing.
Yeah, there's some nice, it's just subtle, you know, obviously. The Allman Brothers style kind of slide on there is the first time we hear that. That style of slide from Gary Rossington, isn't it? And you've got, you know, even the little birds cheeping at the beginning on the slide. It's just there's little things going on. So the basic structure of the song is dead simple, but there's, you know, it's just there's a little bit in the vocals that sort of happens once or a line, and yeah, it's really clever again. And for a song that's that long to keep it, it just doesn't get tiresome. I mean, obviously, eventually we've all heard it that many times that, you know, it's probably not a song we put on that often. But yeah, to keep it going and it builds twice, doesn't it? It builds vocally and then it builds musically at the end.
And this was another one that, of course, reinvigorated the All Grey Whistle Test kind of session from the earlier days, because, of course, they had the live version from Nebworth. And
that's amazing.
And quite often they would play the two or was it three songs from the studio session that they did as well. So, yeah, so it's quite cool to see that coming back around again. But live, obviously, this, you know, moves into a different territory altogether, doesn't it, with, you know, longer guitar solo and stuff becoming a bit of a showcase for the six-string
I mean, it's hard to, I always picture the live sort of Nebworth video version.
Yeah.
You know, with Leon Wilkinson's Curly Lee running out of room and
not being able to get down the runway. Yeah, exactly.
You can't go and join them.
Yeah.
That's just amazing. He's got a big hat on, hasn't he?
He has. Yeah.
Pieces.
I mean, some facts that they sum the song up perfectly, saying you'll be hard pressed to find a rock song with more emotional and cultural impact than Freebird. Those last 4 minutes comprise perhaps the most famous instrumental passage in rock history. And I think that's something you can't deny. Like, I imagine if you're listening to a podcast about kind of rock music, you will have heard Freebird. But even if you think you haven't, like, even if you've got a passing interest in rock music, you will have heard this song. You will have, exactly, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, the opening lyric, "If I Live Here Tomorrow, Would You Still Remember Me?" was inspired by Alan Collins' then-girlfriend, Kathy. I think, am I right in thinking she ended up being his wife, I think? She asked that very question, during an argument. Johnny Van Zandt has referred to Freebird as a love song about a guy and a girl. And I think, you know, we've talked about this kind of Ronnie songwriting all the way through, that it's obviously, you know, we may not have lived a life in the way that he did, but he's got a way of just making things so relatable on such a fundamental level. Do you think that's one of the strengths of this song, that it is just something we can all relate to?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, you've got that sort of, we can all relate to it in our own lives, but also that poignancy around the tragedy as well, the links to that, which just wasn't the intention of the song. But you know, it's hard for me to listen to it and not think about that and what happened to him and the Gaineses and the others. So yeah, it's got that added poignancy to it.
And live these days as well, you know, kind of with the multimedia performance that they bring to the song, you know, you end up with pictures of Ronnie in the background and stuff like that on the big screens behind the band. And I can't remember if it's this song or Simple Man where they've actually got a kind of a lip synced a vocal part cut into their live performance. Oh,
I
as
think
well.
It's this one. Isn't it
is this
yeah,
one.
I think
yeah,
he
yeah.
sings it. Actually.
So, so you end up with like Johnny singing the first couple of verses, and then it is actually Ronnie singing coming out of the PA. You know, which is pretty incredible, and you can see the effect it has on the crowd. Even you know, even now, that's very moving.
And I think, I mean, obviously, anyone who's listening, feel free to correct me if I'm ignorantly not. Kind of not thought about this elsewhere, but I think the only other example of that I can think of is Queen, where they get Freddie to kind of sing Bohemian Rhapsody or Part of Love of My Life. I think yeah. they're the only two examples I can think of where, unless it's Ronnie James Dio as a hologram, that's
yeah, exactly. That's yeah, what yeah, I was yeah, just gonna say. Yeah. There, yeah. So, and they've tried a few of those kind of things, like you say, with the projection. Hologram projections, but yeah, I mean, you know, when it's got that kind of connection, it, you know, and you can tell that it affects the band as well as the people in the audience, which is quite amazing.
Yeah. I mean, in spite of the song being credited to Collins and Ronnie Van Zant, this feels like a band collaboration in every sense of the word. And obviously, we've talked quite a bit about obviously how this was Billy Powell's way in the band. We've talked a lot about the solo and. You know, how that kind of develops in live renditions, and that solo itself actually did develop from live shows. Rossington told Classic Rock magazine, "One night we were playing a club and Ronnie said, 'Play that a little longer. My voice is hurting. I need a break.' So we played two minutes or 3 minutes. 2 days later, his throat was all sore and he could hardly talk. And we ended up playing it 10 minutes at the end, just jamming." Yeah. So it seems like the idea of having a solo at then this song seems to have just developed completely by accident, which is always kind of how the best things do happen. But, you know, an absolute rock landmark and, you know, complete accident, really.
But the cool thing about that is still got a kind of a structure with some peaks and troughs and things in it as well, hasn't it? So it's not just a 7 minute vamp on a chord sequence and a guitar solo. You know, it has actually got that lovely, you know, where the breakdown happens and the percussion brings it back in and the accents, and then the next time around it's two accents and then it's three. You know, it's kind of the way that kind of builds through the song, you know, it's spectacular, really. And a lot of that probably did come from jamming, but then they sort of sat down and worked out, okay, well, this is how we're going to put that jam kind of back together to be a bit more interesting than just your average run-of-the-mill sort of extended solo thing, you know, which...
It's got that kind of galloping drum and bass bit in it, isn't it?
Yeah.
Probably so they knew where they were.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah. When are we going to finish this lesson solo?
Yeah.
And I think maybe, as you talked about the keyboards earlier, you know, it's got that great sort of Hammond organ at the start and then that little piano break in it. And that's wonderful, you know, it's... There's a lot in there.
Yeah, there is.
I mean, there's a lot of time to put stuff in, but there's a lot in there.
I mean, obviously, the success of the song has created this running joke at pretty much any live show. Obviously, you know, if a band's taking requests or there's a quiet moment, even I think this has happened to like the likes of Bob Dylan, you know, and among others, you know, that obviously the audience request Freebird, regardless of who's playing, what genre they are. You know, people are saying play Freebird, which I think is testament to kind of its place in pop culture. I mean, there's many theories, I think, as to why it is Freebird that we request. But why do you think that's a running joke that's endured so long? Do you think that's testament to the song?
And no, it's not. It's people taking the mick because they don't think the band can play. That's why they shout for it. They're not going to shout for, you know, Anarchy in the UK or something. You know, they're going to shout for something that they can't play. We know they can't play it.
Yeah. So in 2016, an attendee of a Bob Dylan concert in California shouted for Freebird, and Dylan and the band obliged and did the whole song. So there we go. So an example of maybe them thinking, Dylan will not do that or can't do that. And yet he did, which I think is great.
Yeah, I mean, a story about requests for this song from Nashville. There's, you know, so you can shout out for any song you want for, you know, a lot of the bands up and down the strip in Nashville. And, you know, perhaps you put a few dollars in the tip jar, but most of the bands, you know, if you want them to play Freebird, you put in 50 or $100 in the bucket, and a few times it does get played, often truncated because they want to move on to the next song and get some more tips. But yeah, so there's been a few interesting hollers for the song from the crowds in some crazy drunken place in Nashville.
I mean, obviously, to bring it back to the context of it, obviously, you know, for so many people, you know, it's a song, a piece of work all of its own. But in the context of the album, how does Freebird end the album for you?
That's perfect, isn't it? What a the perfect is. I'm back to the granary now. Last song, you know. Yeah, it's just you need a lie down after that anyway, don't you? You kind of you need to take the needle off or whatever.
Yeah. It's funny because it's always one of two answers. I think when we ask that question, it's either I turn it over and I start again,
yeah,
or I just need time to process what I've just heard.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. I mean, I wish I could have been around in the early 70s to see firsthand how Lynyrd Skynyrd and Pronounce made their mark on rock music forever. I mean, the band that ultimately only see the fruits of that labour for 5 years before that classic lineup would kind of cease to be after that tragic plane crash that we've talked about. The songs of Pronounce, they stand as a lasting legacy for him and the classic Skynyrd lineup, many of whom have passed kind of over the years, over the last 49 years. And I'll leave the last word to Rock and Roll Review, who say this. They say the debut from the Southern Road Rock stomping aggregation served notice that worthy successors to the groundbreaking Allman Brothers had arrived, with one foot in rock and the other in Southern socio-mythology. They lived and played as if the music and the party were the only things that mattered. Strong songwriting, sympathetic production, and Ronnie Van Zant's redneck hollow vocals add up to a Dixie-fried good time, making the intelligence of the lyrics an added bonus. So we're thinking everything we've talked about and bearing that in mind, why do you think that this album has stood the test of time the way that it has?
Well, I mean, I think that sums it up very well. You know, it's a genre defining album. So it has influenced so many, right up to, Blackstone Cherries and the bands that are still writing great new music today, clearly been influenced by this very album. Yeah, I think it is that it was the birth of this band and the huge success that came after it as well, and the stories and the tragedy as well. It's just the whole thing is like folklore. So this was the start of Lynyrd Skynyrd and the whole story of Skynyrd, but it was also the start of a genre of the harder edged blues influence, blues rock influence kind of sound that, it's massively popular today.
And finally, why is Pronounce Lynyrd Skynyrd your classic album? And why should people check it out if they haven't already?
Well, I think it's one of those that, definitely helped us in terms of the formation of our own band kind of thing. But, it's kind of, you go back to discover, okay, you might only know one or two of the songs from the big hits and things, but there's way more in there to pull out given time. Give it a proper 40-minute listen rather than just a 9-minute one song type thing, which is perhaps a little, it's not very common these days, is it?
I'd say
dip in and dip out too often.
Yeah, you can listen to the whole thing, and I'd say definitely get the lyrics up on your screen or if they're on the sleeve, and just read the lyrics as well.
Yes.
They're just great. They're emotive, and they're either, they've got a fun side and that kind of story, but they're kind of very touching. And I think it was nice in that summary, they talked about the intelligent lyrics as a bonus. It just is well worth a listen as a creative thing. If you're into music of any sort, listen to it and listen to this, the song Craft of Tuesday's Gone and the rest of it. It's a masterclass in soulful music that's coming from somewhere quite deep.
Well, guys, thank you very much for joining me, and I think it was about time we did this album. I've been hoping someone would pick this one for a while. Yeah. thank you for joining me. I mean, I know Sons of Liberty, I've been kind of looking on your social media, I know you guys are heading back into the studio in a few months for your next album. Is that right?
End of the year.
We've actually got
a pre-production session in a couple of months time. We've got new songs coming together at the moment, but most of this year is going to be touring and gigging the Aces and Eights album, which we released in the middle of last year. It's going to be a busy old time.
A huge thanks to Fred and Moose from Sons of Liberty for joining me to chat about, I think I've said it loads of times, a really influential album, a fantastic album. It's been on my hit list for years to get this one done on my classic album, so a tick for me. And it takes its place amongst all the other classic albums that we've talked about, particularly this year for season 4. I think we've had a really nice little smattering of classic albums so far, and that will continue over the coming weeks. But just a huge thanks to Sons of Liberty for taking the time out to come on the show. And, you know, you heard what they're going to be up to over the next few months. So absolutely check these guys out. I played Come in Peace earlier on. That's from their album Aces and Eights that came out last year. Phenomenal album, fantastic music. You know, absolutely check these guys out if they come to your town. And that's another one, another episode of My Classic Album done. Thank you very much for joining me for another episode of the show. You know, I said that Pronounced is one that's been on my hit list for a while. Our next classic album is another one that's been on my hit list for quite some time. You know, people often say on social media, I collect the Knucklebones Rock Icon Statue series of kind of all the rock musicians of the past and present that I love. I actually have the album cover of our next album almost kind of reenacted in statue form, which I will be posting, I'm sure, throughout over the next few weeks. I will be joined by guitarist Sammy Boller, who has chosen Ozzy Osbourne's debut solo album, Blizzard of Oz. I mean, what an album, you know. Again, obviously, Black Sabbath, arguably kind of the very start of metal. Ozzy almost reinventing the wheel with Randy Rhoads and Blizzard of Oz. So it's a great conversation with Sammy. We really get into it. A fantastic album. And that's coming on the 1st of April in just a couple of weeks' time. So thank you very much for joining me today. I'm Mike Norris, and I will see you in April. Cheers.